you very much, Stephanie. It's a great pleasure for me to be here this morning. These are exciting times for those of us who are involved in school finance and in education generally. Within the next week or so, we'll hear what the results of the November budget forecast are. So we'll have a sense of what kinds of resources we're working with to fund education over the next couple of years. Within the next month, we'll hear who our new Commissioner of Education will be, who will provide leadership within the administration on education funding and other education issues. Within the next month or so, those of us in the department will be working closely with the governor and the new commissioner in developing a set of governor's budget proposals for the legislature. And then over the next several months, all of us will be involved in working with the legislature in trying to develop a really good set of education funding improvements that will take effect in the next biennium. And I'm very hopeful that with a new governor, with a strong background in education, with a lot of newly elected representatives and new leadership in the House, that the legislature in 2019 will take a close look at education generally and school finance in particular, and make some really needed improvements in our school finance system. And I can't say enough about the critical role that all of you play in working with your local legislators and with state officials in making sure that they are all aware of what your critical needs and priorities are so that they can be fully informed as they move forward making these key decisions. So my presentation is kind of a small effort in that regard to begin with a brief overview of some important principles for school finance, and a little bit of mechanics on how the finance system works. I'm starting at a really basic level here. I apologize if I'm kind of underneath your knowledge, but I want to start from the beginning here and kind of work my way up. Then I'll briefly review some of the trends, what's been going on in school finance over the past 10 or 15 years that have led to some of our current problems and issues that need to be addressed. And then I'll look at some policy options, beginning with what the recommendations were in the 2012 and 2014 School Finance Task Force working groups, and which of those recommendations were adopted, and some of the really significant recommendations that were made back then that were not adopted, and identify some policy options for consideration. I know that you are much closer to the action than I am, you have a lot to say about these things, but just trying to give you a general perspective from a statewide point of view in terms of some critical issues. I do offer some policy options here. These are strictly my thoughts on this, and they do not represent any sort of official Department of Education or governor's position. Just tossing out some ideas for you to be thinking about. So let's start by talking about some just very basic education funding principles. And these really go back to the Minnesota Constitution way back in 1858, when the state was created. The Constitution makes it the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools throughout the state, and also requires the legislature to set up a system of taxation that will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools. So that's been on the books for a long time. Back in the early 1990s, we had a major school finance lawsuit where we learned more about the specifics of what that constitutional mandate requires. That was Skeen versus State of Minnesota. The Minnesota Supreme Court in 1993 set out a ruling that detailed a little bit more. What does that requirement in our Constitution mean? And what they said is that education is a fundamental right in Minnesota, that their decision requires the state to provide enough funds to ensure that each student receives an adequate education and that funds are distributed in a uniform manner. They also said that they're not the experts on school finance, the legislature is, and that in the absence of glaring disparities, they're going to give some leeway to the legislature because they know they're balancing some competing interests, like efficiency, equality, and limited local control. They also said that as long as the state provides an adequate and uniform system of public education, that they have the ability to also allow school districts to go above and beyond that level and to add things that are deemed to be important locally. So that's kind of the fundamental legal basis for our school finance system. So based on those factors, I think there's some general agreement that certain things are important as we design a school finance system. And among those, adequacy and equity for our students. We want to ensure that all school districts and other local education agencies have the resources that they need to provide an adequate basic education for all students and to adjust appropriately for differences in the needs of our students who come to the school system with different educational needs. So we look at, from an economist's point of view, we look at horizontal equity, making sure that all students have access to an adequate education, and that where we have vertical equity, which says we should be providing appropriately different levels of funding for students that have different needs and for school districts that have different characteristics. In addition to adequacy and equity for our students, it's also important that we have equity for our taxpayers. We want to ensure that all local education agencies have the resources that they need to provide that funding level for their students. And typically what that means is that the tax burden for providing that adequate basic education should be essentially uniform throughout the state. And that can be done either by the state fully funding the basic education formula as we do currently, or with a uniform tax levy that's spread evenly across the state so that all school districts have access to an adequate basic funding level with a comparable level of local tax effort. And then secondly, that when school districts need to go above that basic level, that they are supported by the state if their tax base does not allow them the opportunity to do that on an equal footing. So that there needs to be some equalization of additional levies, such as the referendum levy, in order to try to create a level playing field for the taxpayers across the state. And another area that's very important as we think about our education funding principles is we want to make sure we have a system that's stable, transparent, efficient, and effective. We want to make sure that the resources for public schools are allocated through understandable statewide formulas that are rationally related to educational need and that minimize burdensome paperwork. It doesn't seem like too much to ask, but it's very difficult to get there. We also want to make sure that our system provides incentives and flexibility to address local needs and to ensure that the districts have an incentive to operate efficiently and effectively. So I'm going to walk through some mechanics, and again, I apologize if this is kind of too basic, but I thought I should start at the very beginning and kind of work my way through this. So, you know, as I've noted, the Minnesota Constitution makes the state legislature responsible for education funding. You hear a lot about federal requirements and federal mandates, but when it comes to education funding, the federal government has very little in the way of contribution. The federal funding for education is only a very small fraction of our funding levels. So the funding levels and the mix of state aids and local levies are determined by the legislature. Most state budget decisions are made in the omnibus education and tax bills, which are occurring in the odd-numbered year. So we're just on the brink of the 2019 legislative session. That's when the key decisions will be made for the next 2 years. The legislature does come back in the even-numbered years. They make some supplemental budget adjustments, but the big decisions are made in the odd-numbered legislative session. Funding streams can be all state aid, they can be all local levy, or a mix of the two. Most levies are equalized by the state, where the state provides funding that is tied to the school district's property value per student to try to equalize the tax effort that school districts with low tax base make relative to districts with high tax base, so basically all school districts can access the level of funding that they need with a reasonable level of tax effort. So most of our funding is allocated based on the number of students that are served by the school district and the characteristics of those students. Some funding is allocated based on expenditures or other factors. Each school district's funding per student is different. If we had a system that provided every school district with exactly the same amount of funding per student, I'd say there's something wrong with that system, because we know that the characteristics of each school district are different, they're serving different student populations, and the funding needs to vary depending on the needs of the district. Some school funding is unrestricted, meaning school districts can use it for any educational purpose, and other funding is restricted or called categorical funding that can only be used for a specific purpose. The legislature determines what the property tax levies will be for school districts by and large. Once the legislature has established funding formulas that determine local property tax levy authority, the legislature leaves most of the decisions on whether to use all of that authority up to local school boards. Local school boards typically use all of the authority they can get from the legislature. And then we have the opportunity for school districts to go beyond the basic amount by going to the voters for an additional level of funding. Most school levies are spread based on a concept called adjusted net tax capacity. With adjusted net tax capacity, all of the taxable property in the school district pays the bills, but different class rates are used for different types of property. So ag land pays lower tax rates than homestead property, and homestead property pays lower tax rates than commercial industrial property. The operating referendum levy and the local optional levy are based on a different concept called referendum market value, which exempts the ag land and cabin property from the taxes, and also does not use class rates, so the business property pays the same rate as the homeowners. So, as I said, most funding is allocated based on the number of students. In Minnesota, we use a concept called adjusted pupil units to allocate most of that funding. So, adjusted pupil units are based on the average daily membership, the average numbers of students enrolled throughout the course of the school year. And then we weight those students where elementary students are weighted at 1.0 and secondary students are weighted at 1.2. Some examples of our student-driven funding are, of course, the basic formula, $6,312 per student, local optional revenue at $424 per student, operating referendum is a rate per student that's determined in the local election, and then we have a few other formulas, safe schools and so forth. There are also a number of other measures of student counts that we use for different purposes. I won't go through all of the details here, but we count extended time pupil units. English learner ADM is used for EL funding. We have compensatory pupil units, which are based on free and reduced lunch counts. The special ed child count is one of the factors used in special education funding. Protected student count is used for achievement integration, American Indian count, and the October 1 enrollment is used for Q count funding. So there are a variety of different pupil measures that are used for different parts of the school finance system. We also use approved expenditures in a number of our programs, most notably debt service funding, of course, is based on the amount of money you need to pay your bonded debt. We also have expenditure-driven funding for OPEB, for career tech, for pension adjustments, school-age care levy, and the reemployment insurance levy. We do have a number of other factors that go into our school finance system. We use school building age for some of our capital funding. We use population density to determine transportation funding. The distance to the nearest school is used to calculate sparsity funding for isolated schools, and total population is used for our community ed programs. Now, some formulas use a combination of factors. It's not uncommon for us to use a formula that is based partly on the number of students you have and partly based on expenditures. So you'll see that in areas like special education, long-term facility maintenance, charter school lease, and building lease levies. So our school finance system depends to a large extent on the financial data that's provided by school districts. Since 1977, we've had a uniform financial accounting and reporting standards, UFARS, that is used to drive our expenditure reporting to ensure that all school districts are reporting on a comparable basis to the state. It's a modified accrual basis of accounting. It's a multi-dimensional system. And school district funds, you know, unlike business funds, are segregated into certain operating funds and non-operating funds. And there are some pretty strict rules at the state in terms of transfer of money between those funds. So that's a very quick run through the basic fundamentals of school finance. Now I'm going to get into a little bit more detail. So I talked about how we have fund accounting in Minnesota and in other states for our school finance system. The general fund is by far the largest fund. So in 2017, 84% of all of the revenues for school districts were in the general fund. That's going to be the focus of my presentation. The second largest fund is the debt service fund at 7%. I'll say a little bit about debt service as well. So if we narrow into that 84% of the money that's in the general fund, the basic general education formula accounts for 52% of all the revenue in the general fund for the state of Minnesota as a whole. So not surprising when you hear about the legislative session and there's talk about what the legislature's up to, the first thing you hear about is the basic school finance formula. It's where most of the money is. If you look at the balance of the funding for schools, the next largest category of funding for schools is special education aid, which accounts for about 11% of the average general fund budget across the state. And then you've got referendum levies at 6%, compensatory aid at 5%, and a number of other categories. You'll notice the federal government is hardly visible at all. It's 4% of the average general fund budget for Minnesota school districts. So as I said earlier, school funding is driven mostly by the number of students you have in your school district. This is the long-term trend in terms of the enrollment of students in Minnesota school districts. The heavy line at the top is the public school enrollment, and the little red piece on the end is the public school enrollment with the charter schools added. So we've had our ups and downs with the baby boom, the baby bust. We're currently on a slight uptick in terms of the total enrollment in Minnesota public schools. So as the legislature is budgeting for education, we have to set aside a little bit of new money each year for covering the increase in the number of students that we're serving. Down at the bottom of the chart is the non-public school enrollment, and what you see there is we've had a continual decline as the share of our students in public schools grows and the share of students in private schools is continuing to decline. But there's more to the student enrollment trends than simply the total number of students. We're also seeing some pretty important changes in the characteristics of the student body. And what this next chart shows is the breakdown of students by special needs category. So the top line here are the number of students living in poverty. We've had a long-term trend with an increase in the number of students in poverty. But there's been a reversal of that the last couple of years. So we've gone from 38% down to about 37% of our students in poverty in the last few years because of our booming economy. The number of students of color and American Indian students has continued to grow. We are currently at about 33% of our students statewide are students of color and American Indian students. We've had some slow growth in the portion of our students that have special education needs. So students with a disability are currently at about 15%, 15.7% of our total enrollment. And our students that are English language learners has been pretty stable, but it's edging up a little bit. So 8.3%. These trends are important for our school finance system because we know that students in poverty, students that have different needs are going to require different programs, different funding, and the legislature has responded with different kinds of funding mechanisms to try to address those needs. I said a few moments ago that the basic education funding formula is by far the largest piece of our school finance system and accounts for 52% of all of the revenue in the general fund. And unfortunately, over the last 15 years, we haven't done quite so well in maintaining our basic general education funding formula. So what this chart shows, the red line, is the inflation-adjusted general education revenue, basic revenue, per student in 2019 dollars. This is adjusted using the Consumer Price Index. You get different answers if you use other inflation measures. But the bottom line here is that we've lost about $600 per student to inflation over the last 15 years on our basic education funding formula. We reached a low point around 2014. We've seen a little bit of improvement since then, but the bottom line, and I don't have to tell you this, is that we're not able to buy as many things with the basic general education revenue as we used to. So how have school districts coped with that loss of basic revenue? Well, they've gone to the voters to ask for revenue from the referendum levy. So this next chart, the red line, is the inflation-adjusted state average amount of referendum and local optional revenue per student. Well, that's grown by almost $900 per student since 2003. So bottom line, school districts have lost about $600 per student of basic general education revenue. They've gained on the average about $900 per student of referendum revenue over that period of time. And by the way, they're also dealing with a much more complex set of educational needs out there in terms of higher concentrations of poverty, higher concentrations of special education students, and so forth. The next chart is kind of tracking the disparity in education funding for basic education revenue, referendum, local optional, per student between the 95th percentile and the 5th percentile. We've been tracking this disparity ratio since the early 1990s. During the Skeen lawsuit, we had, in the early 90s, we had a 37% difference. I mean, no wonder we had a lawsuit, right? So we're saying some school districts have 37% more money for their regular ongoing operating costs than other school districts have. So as a result of the Skeen lawsuit, we got a cap on the referendum levy, we got equalization of the referendum levy, and that basically held the top down and allowed the school districts that were behind to catch up. The disparity declined to about 18% between 1992 and 2004. And then we had some economic difficulties. The formula wasn't growing, as I just showed you. School districts went out for referendums, and guess what? Some school districts were much more successful in passing referendums than other districts. The disparity went right back up to 31%. Then in 2013, the legislature decided that we needed to do something about that level of disparity. They created the local optional revenue, allowing districts that didn't have a referendum to access $424 per student, and also added the ability for school districts to have a $300 per pupil referendum if they didn't have a referendum. So that lowered the disparity. So we're kind of on a slinky kind of curve here. And we got back down to 18% in terms of our disparity as a result of those changes. Now in the last week or so, we've just received the data from 2020, and we're starting to go back up again in terms of our disparity. So that's kind of the long-term pattern of what the differences are in our funding per student across the state. long-term trend in terms of state special education aid is that we see continuing increases in the level of special education aid, especially state aid for special education. Funding has grown at well above the rate of inflation, but at the same time, the costs are growing at well above the rate of inflation. And the federal government funding has been pretty flat, so it's actually not grown at the rate of inflation. So the bottom line is that when we look at this increase in state aid, but at the increase in cost and the lack of any significant increase in federal special education aid, we're seeing a continued increase in the cross-subsidy. So cross-subsidy is just a fancy term for what's the unfunded cost of special ed that you have to take out of your general fund budget. And so what we're seeing here, the red is the inflation-adjusted number. We're seeing continued growth in the cross-subsidy for special education. When we look at the cross-subsidy for special education, it's clearly not the same in school districts across the state. There are some definite patterns with individual districts, but there are also regional patterns here. And quite clearly, the cross-subsidy is a lot higher in the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul than it is in other areas of the state. Aside from Minneapolis and St. Paul, the cross-subsidy is higher in the metro area than it is in rural. And within the rural part of the state, it's much higher in the larger cities outstate, such as St. Cloud, Rochester, and so forth, than it is in the smaller rural communities. And if you look way over on the far right, you'll see the charter schools, which, as you know, have the ability to transfer 90% of their unfunded costs to the resident school district. And they're looking at a cross subsidy of about $100 per student. So there are quite a bit of variation among school districts in the degree to which they have to take money out of their general education program in order to cover the unfunded cost of special education. Overall, the state of Minnesota does a pretty good job in terms of state support. If you compare Minnesota with Wisconsin, for example, our level of state funding is much higher. We reached an all-time high of 72% state funding in the early 2000s. We're now at about 66% state funding and about 22% property tax funding. For school districts, especially when you're going out trying to pass a referendum, it may be more important what the state share is on the referendum than it is what the overall state share of funding is. So I like to look at what the state share of referendum and debt service is. The blue line here is the state share of referendum funding. The red line is the state share of debt service funding. So with referendum funding, what we've seen is ups and downs, and essentially, the problem that we have had is that the legislature will periodically determine that we need to provide more state dollars to help support school districts with their referendum efforts. We do that, but then the legislature doesn't adjust that for inflation. So as the tax base grows, the state funding goes right back down. So I was very excited back in the 2013 session when the legislature made some really big improvements in the way we equalize our referendum levies. We increased the state share from 8.2% to about 24% of the referendum on the average. It's lower in the metro area than it is statewide, but that was a pretty good improvement. But it's pretty amazing that just between the 2017 school year and we just now finished our November forecast, we're down to 9% statewide. So we've, in just a few short years, that improvement in state share of referendums has just been totally eliminated with inflation over a few years. It's really a crying need for some sort of indexing of our referendum equalization so that we don't have a situation where the state share goes down so quickly. Debt service has always been a much lower state share, and we actually have indexing in debt service, but the level is so low to begin with that it's kind of the cat's already out of the bag, and now we're doing a little bit too little too late. So my next piece that I want to shift to here is to talk a little bit about policy options. And when I was talking to Scott as I was putting this together, we thought that it might be helpful to think about the work that was done by two task forces, one in 2012 and one in 2014, and look at what did those task forces recommend, and what did the legislature actually do, and what's kind of unfinished business. Those task forces, I think, were, in general, very successful. They had broad representation, and they reached pretty close to consensus on the issues that they addressed, and there was quite a bit of discussion at the legislature about the recommendations. So the first recommendation that came out of those task forces was the general education formula. And what the 2012 task force recommended was that we restore the general ed formula back to the 2003 level, adjusted for inflation. Well, the legislature did increase the formula allowance in several of the following years, 1.5% for 2015 and 2% for each of the years between 2015 and 2019. And that actually exceeded the rate of inflation a little bit. So as a result of that, between 2014 and 2019, the gap declined from $741 per student to $617. So basically, we made a little bit of progress in restoring the general education formula in the last few years, but not very much. And there's a long way to go there. The next recommendation that came out of the working group was to simplify some of the pupil weightings that were used, moving to the 1.0 weight for elementary, the 1.2 weight for secondary, and the legislature did that. The working group also recommended that we move toward funding all-day kindergarten, starting with the students that were free and reduced lunch. Well, the legislature exceeded that recommendation by going to all-day kindergarten for everybody. And then we also had a recommendation to replace the old marginal cost pupil unit calculation with a separate declining enrollment formula. The legislature did that as well. Next, we move to the referendum revenue. And there, the working group recommended changing from a system based on an allowance per resident student to an allowance per student served, and the legislature did that. The working group also recommended rolling $300 per student of referendum into the basic formula, which would provide districts without a referendum a $300 increase. The legislature didn't do that, but their change that made $300 per pupil of referendum revenue available without an election essentially had the same effect. School districts that couldn't pass a referendum got that $300 increase. Next, we go to the local optional location equity recommendations. And what the working group recommended there was that we take into account the cost differences between the metro area and the rural area of the state by allowing metro districts that to basically convert $400 per student of their referendum revenue to location equity revenue, and then if they could go back and pass another referendum, they would have an additional funding level to meet those needs. So the legislature did that, something very close to that in 2013, adopting the local optional revenue. But then in 2014, they changed that recommendation so that all school districts in the state would have $424 per pupil of local optional revenue. So I guess for 1 year, we had some recognition of those cost differences. With regard to the uniform general education levy, the working group recommended that we have a uniform general education levy of about $478 million by basically reducing other levies that schools had and replacing it with a uniform levy statewide. The legislature had a token uniform levy that was adopted shortly after that. They put in a $20 million uniform levy, which then got repealed a couple of years later. So not much change on that front. With respect to levy equalization, The working group recommended that we index the equalizing factors for the referendum and debt service levies and deferred maintenance levies, and that we also increase those. So increase them first and then index them so we don't have this up and down pattern. We did see an increase of of equalization on the first $300 per pupil of referendum, which in the short term was very helpful to school districts. But because they did not index that, we've lost the benefit, or a lot of the benefit from that improvement. With respect to the pension adjustment, this is the old pension adjustment, now not the new pension adjustment. The working group recommended that we eliminate the old negative adjustment to school districts' aides that was based on the amount of money school districts saved in 1997 because of a change in the employer contribution rate, and that we provide a positive adjustment for school districts that had a smaller than average benefit from that change. And the legislature adopted that, and I would also say they also adopted a provision that gives all school districts additional pension funding to address the upcoming changes that we're now seeing in the pension costs. With respect to compensatory revenue, the working group recommended rolling the compensatory pilot grants into the regular compensatory formula and providing more flexibility to school districts, going from 5% to 15% on where they spend the money. Well, the legislature ended up increasing the compensatory pilot grants and eventually put them into the regular general ed program, and they increased the flexibility to 50% in terms of where school districts spend those dollars. Other general education recommendations. The working group recommended that we provide funding for EL students for 7 years rather than five. The legislature did that in two steps. The working group recommended that we roll the $50 uniform per pupil allowance that's part of equity revenue into the basic formula, since all school districts get the same amount. And that we also simplify the equity calculation using a statewide formula. The legislature didn't do that, but they did eliminate some of the differences between the metro and the rural formulas, so they're more similar than they used to be. The working group recommended that gifted and talented revenue be rolled into the basic formula, which did not occur. With respect to special education aid, the working group recommended a major increase in special education funding to reduce the cross-subsidy, something between $150 and $200 million per year. The legislature actually adopted something closer to $40 million per year. So only a small fraction of the increase that was recommended by the working group. The working group recommended that as part of that increase, that we replace the existing initial aid formula with a student-based funding formula. And what the legislature ended up doing was taking a compromise, which made things a lot more complicated, where we now have three different formulas to calculate the initial aid. And that was kind of necessary because of the fact that the funding level was so much lower than what the working group recommended. With respect to excess cost aid, kind of the same thing. Well, the working group recommended that we expand the funding formula to include all non-federal special ed costs, including fringe benefits, which had been excluded. And with the lower amount of funding that was available, that had to be scaled back. And again, we got a more complicated formula to try to make that work. And then with regard to tuition billing, the working group recommended that the serving district or charter school cover 10% of the unfunded cost of special education, and that was adopted by the legislature. Moving to achievement and integration aid, the working group was meeting at a time when the legislature had actually repealed integration aid completely, and the working group recommended restoring integration funding with a formula based on a $500 per pupil times the concentration of protected students, and that it be funded at 100% state aid. The legislature kind of took that recommendation. They moved to a formula based on $350 per pupil, and they kept it at 70-30 state aid. Moving to the 2014 working group, which focused on facilities funding, the working group recommended replacing health and safety, alternative facilities, and deferred maintenance with a new long-term facility maintenance program. The working group recommended that that funding level be set at $300 per pupil the first year, then $400, then $500, and at the end of 4 years, there would not be a per pupil cap. The funding would be based entirely on what the districts needed in terms of their facility improvements. So the legislature took basically a scaled back version of that, where they funded 193 the first year, 292 per pupil the second year, and 380 per pupil after that. So they never got to the point of funding based on the full need for school districts that were not in the alternative. So we still have this gap between the alternative facility districts and the other districts. The working group also recommended equalizing the long-term facility maintenance levy at 125% of the state average adjusted net tax capacity per pupil. The legislature did something very similar. They equalized it at 123% of the state average tax base per pupil, with a little tweak to try to help rural districts get a little better state share. It was very encouraging to me to see this go in, because now we were getting the legislature to engage on the concept of indexing some of our equalization formulas. Debt service equalization. The working group recommended reducing the threshold to qualify for debt equalization from 15.7% to 10% of adjusted net tax capacity, and replacing the current two-tiered formula with a one-tiered formula with a higher equalizing factor indexed for inflation, so that more districts would qualify for equalization, and then once you got in, it would be indexed. The legislature didn't go very far along that route. They did do indexing, but they indexed from the current low level, so only the small number of districts that were currently getting aid were benefiting. The working group also recommended that we have enhanced debt service equalization for districts that had had a natural disaster, or that had a very high tax rate for debt service, or that needed to build a new building as a result of a consolidation. And the legislature took one of those recommendations, which was to provide higher equalization for districts that had a natural disaster. Other facility working group recommendations, one of them was to raise the threshold for review and comment to $2 million to try to reduce some of the paperwork. The legislature did that. They also recommended equalizing the building lease levy, raising the allowance for the building lease levy, and allowing districts to use it for building remodeling as well as leasing additional space. Well, the legislature did raise the allowance for the building lease levy, but they didn't expand the uses or equalize that. The working group also recommended equalizing the capital project, sometimes called the technology levy. That didn't happen, and they also recommended increasing the operating capital allowance, which also was not done for a variety of reasons. So that's kind of a quick run through on what the working groups recommended. As you can see, there were quite a few changes made by the legislature in response to the working group, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. So what I wanted to do next is focus in a little bit more on where do we go from here. And I'd like to start with a quick recap of where we're at currently with the general education formula. So as I showed you on the graphs earlier, we've lost ground to inflation in general ed funding over the last 15 years. We're down $617 per pupil unit. The way I count it, if you use the GDP inflator, deflator, we're down more than that. But this is the number that I think we use most commonly. So it's basically a 9% reduction in the real general education formula allowance over 15 years. We know that school districts have offset that by passing additional referendum levies, some more successfully than others. And One of the concerns I have is that reliance on the referendum levy to fund basic education costs has a couple of consequences that are not great for kids and for taxpayers. First of all, it creates some inequities for students and taxpayers that would not exist if we had maintained the general ed funding formula and all school districts had that level of funding. And it also makes the school finance system much more complicated. Rather than saying we've got a formula allowance of $7,000 per pupil, instead we've got school district superintendents and board members and business managers going out trying to renew that referendum levy, and some districts pass and some districts don't pass, the referendum increases. We just have a whole lot more funding formulas to deal with. It just makes the system a lot more difficult to follow and results in more variations. So here's some food for thought. I would suggest that maybe consideration should be given to a two-part strategy to address this issue. Part one would be keep things from getting worse by doing two things. The first thing would be to maintain the buying power of our current general education funding formula by increasing the funding formula for 2020 and later by enough to cover inflation. That would be about 2.4% per year. And secondly, if we want to maintain that current state share of referendum and local optional levies, we should be looking at indexing the referendum and local optional levies based on the changes in the statewide average referendum market value per pupil. So basically, that's a do no harm kind of strategy, keep the things where it's at now and prevent things from getting worse. The second part of that strategy that I suggest people should consider would be to make some changes that would result in improved adequacy and equity and that would simplify education funding. These get to be more controversial. The first would be to restore the basic formula to the inflation-adjusted 2003 level by basically rolling LOR into the basic formula. In other words, LOR doesn't exist anymore. It's now been added on to the general ed formula. It's $424 higher. And we add at least $200 per pupil of referendum revenue onto the basic formula. And then secondly, to restore the state share of referendum and LOR, the portion that's left, to the fiscal 16 level by increasing as well as indexing the equalizing factors. So it's not enough to just index the equalizing factors where we are now. First, we have to restore the state share up to that roughly 24%, and then index would be what I would suggest should be considered. And then the third thing would be to neutralize the statewide levy impact of these changes and create a vehicle for maintaining the state share on a long-term basis by reestablishing the uniform general education levy at a pretty sizable level, enough to eliminate the, or to adjust for the changes in referendum and LOR levies. And the concept behind this is an old one. It goes back to the way that we used to do school finance in Minnesota 20 years ago, which basically was to say, we're trying to maintain roughly a 70% state share on education funding. And when we do that, we have the basic formula partly funded with state aid, partly funded by a uniform levy. So if we want to pay for an increase in the basic formula, the state covers 70%, the property tax goes up to cover the other 30%. It just makes it a lot more doable to create an inflation-adjusted general education formula if we only have to come up with 70% of the cost out of the state budget and the other 30% is covered by a uniform general ed levy. You can't get there unless you have a uniform gen ed levy that you can adjust. So that's my thinking on that. And as I said, this is just ideas I'm tossing out. They are not an official policy of the governor or the new commissioner. They're just some food for thought. So, in addition to some of these major changes I've talked about, I've got some kind of penny ante changes that I've been pushing for a few years, so I'm just going to take the opportunity to hit you up with those as well. The first one is that when we created all-day kindergarten funding, we made a small technical error. We didn't provide the same level of funding for kindergarten students with a disability that we provide for other kindergarten students. So just think about it. You know, does it make sense that we provide less money for kids with a disability that are in kindergarten than other kids? You know, most people would say, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. So currently, basically, you have to have 875 hours to get one ADM for a kindergarten student with a disability, 850 hours if they don't have a disability. And then kids without a disability, if they need extra help between, you know, kindergarten and first grade, they can get extended time funding and get a little extra help. Special ed kids, no, we don't provide extra time for that. Well, we do, but you have to take it out of your budget. So it's just an inequity there that would cost, you know, like $200,000 a year statewide to fix, but we haven't been able to get that one done. I'm hoping it happens this year. The second one is that I'd like to see that we could simplify the equity formula. We can go to a statewide equity formula and keep the equity formula limited to the original intent, which is to help school districts that have a relatively low referendum, give them a little bump. There are very little difference now between the metro formula and the rural formula. But we have to go through all the hoops, all the calculations twice, and it's just a very simple thing to create one statewide formula that works for everybody. So that's my advertisement. Then, special education revenue, another area that needs some work. So, to recap the current status of special education funding, special education funding has been increasing significantly. Under the new formula enacted in 2016. So we got not only the $40 million increase the first year, but the growth rate has been a lot faster than it would have been under the old inflation-based system. However, it hasn't been enough. The cross-subsidy continues to grow every year. We also know the cross-subsidy is higher for metro districts than for rural districts, especially in the core cities. We also know that the growth cap and the hold harmless that were put on the new special ed formula, because we didn't put enough money in on the front end to try to address all of the needs we had, has created some real inequities. It's based on 2016 data. The farther we get away from 2016, the greater the inequities are, because for some districts, 2016 was a really low year and that created a low base, and for other districts, it was a high year. And we know that the rates of growth for special ed have changed a lot since 2016. So I'm thinking we need to get rid of the growth cap and the hold harmless and find a better way to adjust special education funding. Also, we've noticed that when we shifted to using prior year data for special ed, that creates some problems too, because some districts have much greater changes, much greater growth in special ed costs from one year to the next, and so if we're always funding based on prior year data, we're creating some additional inequities there that I think need to be addressed. So what could we do to fix the special ed formula, so to speak? Well, there are a lot of things you could do, but here are some ideas that I'll toss out, and I'm sure other people have many other ideas. And so I'm thinking that we should be advocating to increase special education funding by at least enough to prevent the cross-subsidy from growing, at least on a state aggregate basis. I've done the math on that, and it would be roughly $30 million a year in 2020, and like $80 million a year in 2021, 100 and some million, it keeps growing. So that would be a significant new investment in special ed funding to keep the cross-subsidy from getting worse. We have a pupil-driven portion of the special ed formula. There's pluses and minuses to that, but if we're going to have a pupil-driven formula, we should be updating it. Right now, the pupil-driven formula is based on the 2012 data that we had when we adopted the formula. There's a requirement in law that we report to the legislature annually on what the most recent cost per pupil is. We should try to get that adjusted into the formula if we're going to have a pupil-driven basis. So it's based on current information rather than stuff that's getting older and older. We should try to see if we can base the aid on current data rather than prior year data. and we should try to eliminate the growth cap and the hold harmless. And you know, we might have to replace them with something different, but the longer we use the 2016 data to calculate those, the worse it gets. Facilities funding. Where do we go from here? So I think we need to go back to the recommendations that our facilities working group made for debt service equalization. We should lower the threshold so that more districts qualify for debt equalization. We should replace the two-tiered equalization formula with a single tier that's equalized at a relatively high level and indexed so that the funding is stable over time. If you go out and you pass a bond issue, you should have a fairly stable share over the life of the bond issue rather than, oh, we got 10% state aid the first year, and the second year the aid was all gone because our property tax base changed. With long-term facility maintenance, I would argue that we should be increasing the allowance up to the level that our largest districts have, which was pegged at $500 per pupil by our 2014 working group. It's probably above that now. So we're currently funding $380. That continues to create a gap between the haves and the have-nots when it comes to facilities maintenance. Capital projects, technology levy. I know a lot of districts in this room have one of those. They're great. But districts with low tax base have a harder time passing one of those than districts that don't have a low tax base. So if we're going to rely on that to fund our technology, we should make it fair by having some equalization provided for all districts. Safe schools funding. Well, that was a big focus of the legislature and probably one of the biggest disappointments last year is we didn't get some improvement in schools safety funding last year. I think the governor's recommendation from last year was a good one, which would be to double the safe schools levy from $36 to $72 per pupil unit, and then to equalize the school safety levy. The nice thing about that is it provides each school district with the flexibility of do we need to address school safety by hiring additional staff? Do we need to address it by changes to our building? That could be done locally by deciding how best to do that. And then secondly, we had this idea for school safety grants. It wasn't a bad idea. We had a lot of interest. We had $25 million appropriated, and we had $257 million of requests. So now we have a hard quantified number that says, gee, we were only able to address 10% of the need. And oh, by the way, we're now creating a lot of inequity within school districts by saying this school gets to be safe, this other school doesn't get to be safe unless you want to take money out of your general fund or pass a bond issue to cover it. So we should continue to move on that front and do some more in terms of the building side of things as well. Other funding, well, we know that voluntary pre-K is an issue. Many of you had voluntary pre-K programs approved for 2018 or maybe 2019, and now we're going to lose 4,000 slots under current law. So it seems that at a minimum we should allow the districts that have made the effort to create those programs to continue to receive those, and I'd also like to see some expansion of that in the future. And then finally, we have the American Indian Tribal Contract Aid. That's been a big priority for our commissioner, where the tribal contract schools receive a lot less funding than our public schools do. And this would ensure that they have funding that's a little more comparable going forward. Under current law, they lose, I think it's about $1,500 per kid between this year and next year. So they've got some real equity challenges there as well. So it's a little bit after 9 o'clock.
Yeah, we have time for a few questions, yep. If that's mm-hmm. all yep. right. So, questions?
Yeah. Good morning, and thank you, Tom. Quick question on each of the, at the end of your presentation here, you've had solutions. Are you able to quantify those? Break that down and
very good question. Total. I didn't get to the point of having numbers for those yet because they're all going to change with the new November numbers. But let me put it in perspective by saying that I think 2 and 2 on the formula is about $400 million. The February forecast suggested we have a surplus of $420 million. So bottom line, there isn't enough money, at least based on the February forecast, to do all of those things. Just 2 and 2 on the formula, not to mention 2.4 and 2.4. That would already put us over the $400 million level, which is the money we had. So I'm hoping that the November forecast is better. With special ed funding, as I said, for basically just increasing the funding enough to keep the cross-subsidy from growing statewide is, I believe, about $30 million the first year of the biennium, and about $60 million, so about $90 million to do that. So now we're up to roughly $490 million to do 2 and 2 on the formula, and then the other. And I quite honestly haven't costed out all of the other things. All I can say is that the legislature is going to have to do some difficult prioritizing to make this work.
Other questions?
Thank you. Tom, really appreciate the overview of all of it, but particularly the school safety analysis. Just one point I want to make there is that the application for the school safety was limiting in itself. So it's not a true analysis of what our needs are. We had a list of needs, and then once the app came out, we had to limit those needs to fit the application. So I would love to see something done on a state level that we do a complete analysis.
Thank you for adding that. That's important.
A question right here, Dr. Melcher. Thanks for your presentation. My question would be, you talked about the Skeen decision in 1993, where the court said that the state was providing adequate funding for education. That was at a time where education requirements were based on seat time. Today, of course, that has changed, and adequate education is based on obtaining a proficiency score on an MCA test or more. And as your data showed, the demographics of our students have changed dramatically. First of all, do you think that the courts would rule today that the state is providing an adequate amount of funding to achieve the state education goals? And secondly, is it going to take a court case to change education funding in Minnesota?
That's a very difficult and good question. I agree with your analysis. Certainly, when the Supreme Court ruled in Skeen, they were looking at seat time and do you have licensed teachers. It was all inputs, and now we've shifted to outputs for our analysis. I wouldn't want to speculate on what the outcome of a court case would be, but I think you've got the standard, and we've got some real questions. That's about as far as I'd want to go.
We'd have time for one more if.
Yes. Yep. I'll be right there, Sandy.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. As always, you provide insights to a really complex topic. I would just add that there are so many barriers to kids at all levels of public schools getting mental health services that my experience tells me those directly impact the cost of special education and of safe schools. And until we can address supplemental funding from public and private insurance to supplement education funding, I think we're going to continue to see the safe schools needs increase and the cost of special education increase. So I think there's some thinking that could contribute to how do we partner across those lines to get those services adequately provided.
Thanks, Sandy. I know that's a very important issue. We've made some small progress with some school mental health grants, and something that certainly needs to be looked further into. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you here this morning.
Let's give Dr. Melcher a round of applause. Thank you. With that, we have a 10-minute break.